Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Hope you are all doing well, and the pandemic continues, but the vaccine is rolling out. I think they said somewhere about 10% maybe of the population has gotten the vaccine. So maybe we are getting to the point where we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Today, we are very excited to bring you Josh Gray. Josh is the Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Policy at the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. He is based in Washington, D.C. Normally, we would be doing this interview in person, but it is we are in the days of COVID, so we are doing it remote. Josh, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I am doing well. Thank you for inviting me. Really excited. This is my first podcast, even though I've actually created a podcast of my own. I've never recorded one, so this is really exciting.
Well, maybe this might be the impetus to get you to actually start your podcast. So maybe that will be our goal. Try to make it that good. So we were introduced by Stephanie Reich from Stateside.
Yeah. So Stephanie, a really good friend. My last job was at the National League of Cities in DC. And there I was a director of strategic partnerships. Stephanie had a handful of clients who did work at the National League. So Stephanie plays as a liaison kind of between corporate partners or her clients and NLC. And so we just totally clicked, became really cool friends. And you know, it's one of those things where, you know how you will meet someone because it's job related and then you always talk to them because it's like work related. And then post-job, that's to determine if that can be your real friend. And so since leaving NOC, we've remained friends. So she's a real friend, as I like to call it. Not a DC, what you can do for me, vice versa type of friend. A transactional friend. She's actually like a true, I always say I start this kind of the 3T approach. I started this maybe after college, which is the 3Ts I based everything on, which is building trustworthy, transformative, and transactional relationships, and not transactional in a monetary way, but in a way of like, how are we coming together? How are we viewing each other and getting things done? And so I've always kind of had that approach, a very 3T approach work-wise, but then sometimes that overlaps with some of your personal relationships as well.
I like that. Trust, what was the second one?
Trust, transformative, and
transactional. I love that. Mm-hmm. That is great.
I've used that a couple of times in interviews, and they were like, we're taking it. We're taking it. So I feel like I should like trademark the 3T approach.
The 3T approach. I do like that. It reminds me, we had a guest on, I think it was John Raffaele, or I always forget, Rich Gold, who talked about, I think it was John Raffaele who coined the phrase, the 4 Ps that he looks for when he's hiring someone. And it's someone who, the personality, they understand public policy, they understand politics, and their personality. And he looks at all those, and if they have the right combination of those, he thinks that they'll do well in this business of government relations. He said, you know, the old days where you just, you know, maybe knew politics or just knew people is no longer enough. And when, so he said your 3 Ts, I'm like, I like that. That's pretty good. Gonna have to add that to the repertoire. 3 Ts, trust, transformative, and transactional.
Yeah, I think that goes hand in hand. You know, when we start thinking about the lens of politics and lobbying, obviously, in-person is extremely important, but we saw a shift in the past, maybe within the past 7 to 8 years, where the transition had been less, more lobbying, obviously, but the actual people, the organizations became the microphone. You know, when you talk about issue advocacy, it came from a third party, right? It came from those organizations who are directly impacted. We can talk about whether you're, what side you're on net neutrality, when you have to submit those statements to the FCC, when you have to deal with broadband, when we have to, you know, when you had, you know, some issues focused on, as you know, for example, import-export was a huge thing of passing that during the Obama year. You have to have someone else and to be that microphone. And those are organizations. Those are third-party organizations. So for me in that work, I had to build those relationships with those organizations, whether left or right. And so I had to build that transformer relationship that's trustworthy for them to understand that I would never put them in a compromising situation where whatever they're signing on to did not actually align to their beliefs of the organization. So I built that transformer, I built that trustworthy, and then transactional came at the end where one, it then propelled their organization, whether it was op-eds they were published in, but then also maybe on the other end, the company might have given them money towards the end of the year. And so I've always had that approach in the very beginning, even when I started as a fundraiser. And then when I got into that third party strategic alliance work for Fortune 500 company.
Well, you are exactly right, Josh, because if you lose any one of those and if you lose that trust, they're not going to work with you again. And so it's a very, very good point. And I can see where you and Stephanie would get along. I would encourage anyone, particularly all you people who work on the at state level, if you're not familiar with Stateside, which I can't imagine, but you should get familiar with them. And if you don't know Stephanie, I would reach out to her and post-COVID when you're in DC, stop by and see her. Some great people at Stateside. They have a podcast called State Bites. It's a really great podcast and just some great people there. So Josh, let's go back to where it all began. You're on the East Coast now, but you're kind of from a West Coast kid. You grew up in the Bay Area. Tell us about growing up in California, which I got to say, coming from New England, I'm sure it's not all sunshine and fun, but man, it just seems, and we're in the dead of winter. Growing up in California just sounds nice.
No, yeah. You know, it's so funny. So I'm here in DC and I moved back, I guess, in March of last year, right in the middle of COVID. I went to Howard. So I was actually in DC for 16 and a half years before I moved back to California for 3.5 and moved back. And so it's so funny. We say a California kid. And I'm like, I'm an East Coast kid. So people are like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm so East Coast. And I think for it's so funny because when I moved home for 3.5 years, it made me realize, man, Josh Gray, you really are an East Coast. You're so East Coast.
You prefer the East Coast.
It was so slow. It was so slow.
Yes, it is slower. We interviewed, I think it was Alan Ehrenbaum in LA. And I said, so what's the biggest difference about life in LA or California? And he just held up his hands. He's like, we're outside year round. He's like, it's just a slower pace. He said, when you can go out and walk and ride your bike and surf every day of the year, you're just not that focused on the memo that you got to do.
It sounds like he was in Southern California. I should say, definitely, Mark Twain said his coldest winter was a summer in San Francisco. So let's be very clear.
Yes.
My friends would give me a lot of shit when I tell them I have cashmere year-round. They don't understand that concept because it gets really cold in the summer.
Because the Bay Area can be chilly.
Because the Bay is really chilly.
Yeah.
Well, with that said, you know, I'm just a kid that grew up with an older sister. I actually have a lot of siblings, a lot of sisters, but I grew up with an older sister who was a year older, and then a sister 6 years younger. But my older sister and I, we grew up very beginning in West Oakland, California, Acorn Projects. So basically government housing.
In West Oakland, you said?
In West Oakland.
Okay.
And so in the 80s. So imagine right in the thick of the crack pandemic, or epidemic, I should say. I think it's a both. I think it was the epidemic and the pandemic. Because I think of it from the health crisis part of it as well. We then eventually moved to Berkeley, California, which is a more of a suburb, affluent neighborhood, with the luck of Section 8 housing and then eventually move over to public housing. We grew up initially in West Oakland with our mother. Father was never around. Mother was a drug addict. Kind of the government then took us away. Then grandmother then became our legal guardian, so essentially became our foster care parent. And so we then moved to Berkeley, when I was 7 years old.
Wow. So at 7 years old, the state took you out of your mother's care and put you in your grandmother's care.
Yeah, it was probably just, you know, I'm not for sure if you actually deal with this, Jim, but I have a vivid memory. So I think I have a really good memory, but even more so when I was younger. I remember like it was yesterday, because no one can see me, but I'm kind of snarling about it because, you know, shit happens. It was like this knock at the door. It was like, who's knocking? I remember I was like six, like, who's knocking at the door? It's the police. Well, the police comes in and they listen, here's a warrant. We're taking your kids. My mother has fallen out. She's crying. And my sister and I were crying. We don't know. And I just remember my sister and I sharing the front seat of a police car. We asked them to turn the sirens on. And for about 2 months, we went to an actual foster home. And I remember that time because my sister and I were hanging out at the woman who was our foster parent, essentially, for the moment. My grandmother and aunt drove past because they didn't know where we were at the time. They were actually applying, or my grandmother was applying to become our guardian. And we like start crying, like hugged, and it was like crazy because, again, for 2 months, they didn't see us. We didn't know. My mother did not know where we were. And it was like so surreal for my sister and I. And yeah, that was really kind of.
And at that time, you were 7 and your sister was how old?
8. Or I was probably 6 and my sister was 7.
Wow. And the police come take you out of the home.
That night, middle of the night, put us in this foster home for about a month and 2 months.
And you ask the police if they can put on the sirens. I mean, if that's not the response of a 7-year-old, obviously you're upset. I mean, beyond upset. But,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I often think of those things. And, you know, I think life is really, Jim, it's not a piece of a puzzle. And for good or bad, they're all pieces of puzzles. And then when one puzzle is completed, you move on to other pieces. And so I look at my life when I was younger, just pieces of a puzzle. You know, coming home, my mom was a drug addict. All of our toys were sold for drugs. You're upset. Those are pieces of the puzzle that built me to be stronger. And I think in life, when I look back on it, the challenges, you know, when I look, reflect, my mom was beaten by drug dealers. My mom beat up drug dealers. You know, I've slept under drugs and guns underneath my bed and seen a lot of things, but also understanding those are pieces of puzzles that eventually just make you. So we're in life, we often build millions of puzzles. And we can't take what's good out or what's bad out. We take what's good and bad and make that a learning and a teaching process to move forward. And so that's where, for me, I've learned that I just have millions of puzzles in my mind that I've completed, whether it's good and bad, and I take that and move forward.
And so after 2 months in foster care, you go to live with your grandmother in Berkeley?
Yeah, my sister and I, and my grandmother in Berkeley.
And I can't imagine you and your sister at that age, how you coped with that, really that trauma. I mean, that's quite intense. I mean, you are laughing about it. Just so you know, the people listening don't have video, and and Josh is not smiling all the time, but he is smiling. So it's a little off-putting, but that had to be fairly traumatic.
You know, I'm laughing about it because I didn't deal with my trauma until recently.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
You know,
yeah.
And so
when you were 7, you blocked it out and you coped with it however you had to cope with it.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, this is always a deeper issue when you talk within the Black community, when you talk about how we deal with trauma, how does a Black man deals with trauma, and then what is the perception of therapy itself within the Black community and having that, right? There's this misconception of dealing with therapy is not the way. You don't need to deal with that. You don't have to deal with that. You don't have to do therapy. That's not an option. Or that's something we don't do. So there is this misconception that like therapy is not something we need to do within the Black community. And continue to break those stereotypes and break those molds that we need to do that. And so that's something. So when I think about that, you know, I've had to deal with that trauma because even later on, with my relationship with my grandmother, you know, my sister and I became really close. But for me, not saying my grandmother never loved me, because I knew she did, but I felt like nobody loved me. And the only person who loved me at the time growing up for a long time was my mother, who was not as involved. So my mother was a drug addict who came in and out of our lives. And even though we were in foster care and you weren't supposed to see your biological mother, my mother would come around here or there. Mm-hmm. That impacted me because the one person I felt like who loved me was not consistently around, which later on in life really had impacted my relationships with women and my friendships and my inability to be vulnerable and be true to myself and be true to the person who I say that I love or someone who I felt like I was close to. So I can laugh at it now because I've had to go through.
You've been dealing with it.
Yeah.
Well, I can, I think, you know, with the name O'Brien, obviously I'm Irish and, for better or worse, I think I'm like 99.9% Irish. It is a similar viewpoint of therapy in the Irish community. So I think we got the same handbook. Well, first of all, and so your mom would come by sporadically.
So my mom would come by sporadically. My grandmother was very verbally and physically abusive.
Oh, boy.
did not do really well in school. My sister was always extremely smart, year older. And then 6 years later, we had a younger sister. She came, my grandmother actually from there straight from the hospital, took her and then adopted her as well, became her guardian as well. And that was that mold of three. Plus my grandmother, she had, in addition to my mother, she had an older son and a younger daughter. So her younger daughter lived with us as well. We kind of lived in a 3 or 4 bedroom house that was probably under Section 8.
Okay.
But I had those challenging times with my grandmother up until I was 18, essentially until I had to move out with my grandmother, but never really a full in support with my family at all.
And so at 18, you move out. Where do you move to?
So just to rewind, so basically I struggled through school. I think for me, like every Black kid, Black boy growing up, you wanted to play sports. You know, you had two dreams. You played sports or you looked up to drug dealers. And I think I did both. I had an uncle who was a preacher, a minister. I was like a youth minister for a second. And I was, once I got older, I realized that one, I didn't want to be like him. And one, two, I was not fit to be nobody's minister. but I often played basketball, played all three sports, and then eventually settled on basketball, focused on that. And then, and obviously, younger, you want to be a drug dealer. You saw it. You saw the money. You saw the cars. I mean, anybody who grew up that way or you was in that environment, I think that's what you wanted to be because you thought that was cool. And, luckily, I wasn't that type of kid to, I was just scared. I hung around all the people, but I just never did those things. And so the one part, we moved from one place in South Berkeley, California, to the next place in which there was a after-school program, actually a youth center called YAP, Young Adult Project.
What was it called?
Young Adult Project.
Okay, YAP. Yep.
And they provided tutoring for lower-income kids, after-school tutoring. And so I went there and had my friends. We all played ball, but my friends were there. And this white woman with short hair, she comes and who's this white woman tutoring us? And she tutored me and three of my other friends. They're like, oh, whatever. And we became really close. She tutored us for maybe a year.
And at this point, you're in high school.
No, at this point, I'm in sixth grade right now.
Okay. So sixth grade, you're going to an after school program.
Yeah.
You're living in Berkeley and this woman's coming by and tutoring you and your friends. It seems helpful. Seems nice.
Seems super helpful. Like, okay, she's helpful. She's mm-hmm. super nice. After that, probably less than a year, that summer, we stay in contact. My tutor is named Jackie. But it's so funny because I never called her name. It's like, my tutor. So my tutor's name is Jackie. And she tutored three of my other friends. And right in the summertime, she stopped tutoring, obviously, because school was out. And we became really close. And it was so cool because at the time, she was like a sports journalist. And she played basketball. I'm like, wow, like this is a match made in heaven. Like, how do you have this woman who also is like a tomboy, who's not actually gay, who has a jump shot, who's a left hand, you can talk about sports, but then you can't lie about statistics because she can correct you because she's a sports journalist. Right? So it's like, this is perfect. And my first time ever on a plane, she took me to Disneyland in seventh grade. And this woman's like really involved. Like my first time ever catching a football game was I fell in love with USC because Keyshawn Johnson, and she took me to that game. And so it's like, great, this is a great tutor. Amazing. Seventh grade, she's my assistant coach on my seventh grade basketball team in eighth grade. So I'm like, this is great. She's awesome. I then over time realizing that someone who loved me, I think that was my first time of something was more consistent of love for me. And that was really kind of the genesis of our relationship. And me realizing that probably around that eighth grade, going to ninth grade.
And at that point, maybe the first adult who you felt that way about who was reliable and consistent.
Correct.
I mean, you loved your sister, obviously, but the two of you were kind of, trying to face the world together. Your sister was not an adult. And so this is the first adult that you loved that, showed up when she said she was going to show up and did what she said and followed up and was incredibly generous.
Yeah, I mean, that was something new for me. But then it was new for me in that way to then, go to her house and her boyfriend at the time was Larry, and they wind up getting married. My father, once I graduated from junior high school, so back probably in 1996, was it 97 or something? I'm getting my timing off. And all of a sudden now, you know, they live together. So you have these two people, and that was something a lot different, right? They're introducing you to a lot of cultural things and their friends. And then you're the youngest person, and you're the only Black person. By the way, my parents are white. And you forget about that. You're literally seeing two different worlds, even in the same city. I grew up in a place in South Berkeley where the concentration were African or Black Americans and Hispanics compared to where my mother lived or my mother and father lived at the time, majority white people. You know, it's really, even though Berkeley's a small city, it was extremely divided. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been studies on that from the academia side of, you know, the learning spectrum there and who's advancing. And so that breakdown was really that. Like, you may have a white friend, but that white friend, for example, I was a part of the Boy Scouts when I was younger. And so the whole thing in Boy Scout, once a month, each parent would host something. So when it came to me hosting, they counseled. You know, this is liberal Berkeley. You know, this is like the everyone who has the Black Lives Matter, you know, sign in front of their house, their homes. But yet, growing up, like, oh, we don't want to go to South Berkeley. Like, this is too, this dangerous. Like, we don't, this inclusiveness of what we talk about and accepting did not work if that didn't match the zip code or the street address you lived in.
So they canceled?
They canceled.
Wow, in Berkeley.
And I think that's the thing, you know, I'm going to say this, and I think we have to, you know, if we look at history, we have to reflect on, there's this thing, and particularly now, that racism now is going to be about red caps, make America great again. This is racism, right? Racism is the South. We never talk about hot freeways that divided places in California, right? When we think about racism, we think about Jim Crow. Nobody actually talks about, you know, Prop 13, which is a white populist movement back in 65 that really created this division that's really has impacted cities across California. You know, we have to really address redlining in non-Southern states when we think about actual racism through policy. When we think about those things, it's like the South is racist. Bay Area, Berkeley can't be. And it's just not true. The macro and microaggressions I've received growing up, in which, honestly, to be honest, Jim, that's just racism itself. I think the first word, the word micro, was just created in 1976 by a Harvard professor. I think it's a more SAT word for saying racism and covering it up. You know, I've been faced with that. Have I been prepared? Yes. My whole, you know, from 11 years old, there was no need to be uncomfortable, or I couldn't be uncomfortable to a degree, because all of a sudden your whole life is like a bunch of white people and you're like 12 years old. And so instead of using the word put, you use the word pit, because there was no one in your household to correct you, your grammar, right? How you enunciate. And then all of a sudden you've gotten older. You're now being introduced to a family that's educated, where I think at one point my grandmother only had a sixth grade education. And at that point then, high school was the highest in our house, in our household. Mm-hmm. Right. So now you're now moving into someone who's tutoring you with undergrad at Ann Arbor, a master's at Berkeley, and then her husband's Amherst, and then two masters and one from Berkeley. So understanding that significance in the change of roles and how you communicate from a part of a grammar academia, and also holding you to a higher standard when you had no standard in another place.
Yeah, the two worlds that you lived at the same time is really incredible. I mean, it's not as if too that you lived in one world and then moved to another world. I mean, you're living in one world, and then you're having, you know, this after school program with Jackie. And by the way, for our listeners, when Josh is talking about at this point, when he says his mom and dad, I think you're talking about Jackie, what you call your foster parents, Jackie and Larry.
Yeah, and I call them my parents. So Jackie and Larry.
But I mean, it's just it's incredible. When you talk about, so basically what you're saying is the racism or the bias or whatever, the microaggressions up north is just a lot more subtle than down south.
Right.
But not very different.
But not very different.
In the end.
In the end. And it's your policy, how you treat it. And I think that's what's really we have to see that. You know, I was talking to Jackie, my mother, about this, and she was saying recently, man, I don't know. I'm conflicted about having a Black Lives Matter sign in our window.
Jackie was conflicted.
Well, yeah, right?
Okay. And
the hashtag of Black Lives Matter, the hat and the sign has become the it thing. It's become like the sexy thing. And I always say, I don't want to do anything that's sexy. I want to do something that's permanent, because sexy often fades away, right? And so we're not talking about, you know, yeah, the hashtag is fine, but how do we do deeper work on yourselves as white people, as non-Black people, as non-brown people, around implicit biases, around those issues that you know within work issues that you dealt with? When you see a Black man walking down the street, right? Doesn't take away you don't have it, but is it more so I'm masking behind this Black Lives Matter sign when I know I'm going to have some deeper issues when it comes to race?
So you stay with your grandmother through high school and continue seeing Jackie and then Larry.
I did.
At these after school programs or whatever it would be called.
I did. It's funny. 6 days out of the week, I grew up in the poor family, and my grandmother, I should say, provided as much as she could provide. I started really, became ineligible playing basketball in my ninth grade year, had a 1.67. I was probably sixth or seventh grade reading and math level in my ninth grade year, and then eventually improved. But my life was very much one day of this upper middle class white family, and this other 6 days of this. Very verbally, very physically abusive, of, you know, didn't really care if I succeeded in school. What was a priority was more of like cleaning of the house. Those are the challenges I faced, because I understand, if you don't have it at home and if you don't have it at school, what is your pathway? We often talk about systems and we talk about how do we set kids up for success. And I would go back, I don't think I'm a policy wonk, but I'll go back to Bill Clinton's the Welfare Reform Act. When we go back to 1996, was drastically underfunded by billions of dollars. The whole point of that was to get people off of welfare, right? The system of welfare. And that's a larger picture, because you need to increase minimum wage. And right now we see the minimum wage fight to 15, you have people pushing to 11, whatever. The goal there was to get people to get the family members to get associate degrees, to get the college degrees, to set them up for success. Those parents who are on welfare was to set them up for success. That was the goal. And the challenge, though, here was, if it's underfunded, how can the parents be able to read? How can parents be able to go get these associate programs and get these college degrees? How can they then be able to provide, be the resource for their kids when they need help through high school and junior high? And the challenge I felt with my grandmother was, she wasn't there. If I didn't have, she did not support me. Then secondly, even she didn't have the tools as far as the degree that would have helped her, you know, she didn't have the degree. So maybe that would have helped her with, you know, having, for example, a fully funded Welfare Reform Act that would allow, hypothetically, my mother to attain a college degree or to attain this associate degree to then help me. Because if she doesn't know how to read, how could then she help me do my homework? And so we saw that what we're seeing now more than ever, what I was faced with, was I didn't have a grandmother who was supporting me, nor did I have a grandma who's educated enough to even help me with my work. So you have it's like a double entendre. Like, I don't have the support, and nor does she have the education. So you look at programs, it's like, we can't sit here and say, okay, kids, you can do this and we can get you this help at school if you don't have it at home. And so I had this challenge of like not having an educated grandmother. My mom was a drug addict, but still wasn't educated. And then you're fucked. And I was in that situation, you know. I'm not sure if I can curse on your podcast, so I'm sorry.
You can. We had someone drop an F-bomb a year ago, and we've been explicit ever since.
Okay.
So getting back to your life, you're 18. And do you move out on your own, or you move out with Jack and with Jackie and Larry? What happens then?
So, well, actually, my junior prom, I remember coming back to my grandmother's house, and I was telling her, listen, I'm done. I don't want to live here anymore. I don't feel loved. I don't feel supported. This is what this is. And at the time, my aunt, and with any Black community, we say auntie. It's like any Black or brown community, we say auntie. And so auntie, she just had a kid and she was going back to work and she was no longer with the father of her child. So it was perfect. She went to work in the evening time and I'm home by 5 o'clock from school or from, you know, I work and then at school. So it was like perfect timing. So she goes, well, I talked to Lisa. You can go live with her. Fast forward, my sister, who's a year older, she got pregnant at 15 and then wound up having her baby and getting married, moved out the house. But they kept a bed in the room with my little sister because in foster care, you receive a check per kid. And so if the social worker comes by, there's still a bed there. So I left my junior year. At the time, my grandmother and my aunt, they split my paycheck. They split my check up and I got $100. I worked, but I didn't, my aunt would never buy me groceries. My grandma wasn't, she didn't have to worry about anything because I wasn't there, but she still kept a check. And my senior year, I remember this like it was yesterday. November the 1st, I turned 18. That's still my first semester in my senior year. I received a student came into my classroom and said, oh, your college counselor or your counselor would like to meet with you. There's a meeting. I come downstairs and then there's my social worker and she says, I just went over your records and you can graduate a semester early. So basically we're going to stop your foster care payments December. So why? Well, it's illegal for you to live with your aunt and your grandmother. So you're only supposed to live with your grandmother. I said, well, okay, well, I can move back in. Well, no, actually, you're 18 now. And you have enough credits to graduate from high school. I said, well, yeah, but I want to go to college. I needed another semester of high school to have my college credits. And she said she didn't care. So I was going to be cut off completely.
So it's November of your senior year of high school. You're meeting with a social worker in the hallway, and she's basically saying, you got enough to graduate. You're done with school in December. And by the way, you're on your own. You have nowhere to live.
Well,
basically.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Right? So I'll take you back to the 1.67 in, sixth and seventh grade reading and math level. And then by my 12th grade year, I was 3.7 student, president of the Black Student Union. I was a student representative on the Berkeley School Board. I led one of my best friends who unfortunately was killed years ago. He was accused of hitting a police officer. So then I led a walkout into the City of Berkeley jail with a bullhorn and later on dropped those charges. He was in a book called Class Dismissed. And they interviewed me. They were like, why are you doing this? And because at the end of the day, I know a lot of my friends didn't have the opportunities that at that moment I had. And they all figured out I was almost homeless my senior high school. So it was like this whole, all this was happening from like my freshman year of, essentially, as you know, being a Black male in foster care, I was held back in first grade. They already had my bed made up for me in the state penitentiary. Statistically, my bed was made up. We know that, right? It's the statistics. Statistically, we know that the percentage is higher for a kid who was transitioned from foster care to the prison system, from foster care to the homeless system. We know that.
Yep, much higher.
Much higher, right? Much higher. So my bed has often been made up, and I've just been so fortunate not to lay in that bed. You know, and so for me, for all that to happen, I think it's like, beyond having a bed, I had a home. And so when I called Jackie and Larry, and I said, you know, I had this 1.67 and my Jackie and Larry got really involved, you know, in having a vision. I often say, unfortunately, I have white parents. Unfortunately, my mother's Jewish. Like, you know, I always joke when we say that, but they loved me when no one else loved me. They had a vision for me when I couldn't see what was around the corner for me.
I mean, I have so many things I want to ask you, but talking about the 1.67 to the 3.67, were they the difference in that?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
You know, I had a grandmother who wasn't attending PTAs or, you know, I had an opportunity to look for tutors and, you know, tutoring comes with money or, you know, the opportunity to talk to a teacher who then wants to actually invest that time. You know, I was going to school at 7 o'clock in the morning with a teacher who would invest in me just math alone.
And it's interesting, you mentioned, you said vision. Was that one of the things that she showed you a future where it could be a lot different?
I don't know. I think she directed me. She's like, you know,
she didn't make it optional. She's like,
I don't think so. I think when you haven't had love and you understand the urgency, or you understand what love feels like, it's not hard. You have some people who fight it. You have some kids who might have been sort of in the same circumstance as myself, or who's like fighting it. But I welcomed the love and I welcomed that direction because I didn't have it for so long. And so here's an opportunity where this is that, like someone's guiding me. Like I have this family.
So why do you think as you mentioned earlier, the lure of the drugs and the money and the cars was pretty powerful. Why do you think you were able to turn your back on that and pursue the schoolwork and all of that? I mean, obviously Jackie inspired you and showed you the vision and pushed you and all that. But at the end of the day or the beginning of the day, you had to do the work and you had to decide to do that.
I think there's two things. I had a father. You know, one thing that I think my siblings didn't have was a mother and father. All of a sudden now I had a mother and a father.
Larry.
Yeah, Larry. And I would say this. My father could only teach me 50 to 75% of what it is to be a man. Because a white man can never teach a black kid what it is to be a man. Period. Right? And so I sought that in other ways once I got older. But part is my mother and my father really helped me with that. I was never a follower. Now, listen, I have very fortunate, Jim. I've definitely been in certain situations that, you know, thank God I never, you know, was caught in situations because I wouldn't be here today. But overall, I never followed. I've had friends who've robbed. I have friends who've killed people. I have friends who've been killed. I have a best friend who's been missing since 2005. I just never was that. I kind of just hung around them, but I never had this desire, like, I need to sell drugs, I need to rob somebody, I need to do this, you know? But I'm only saying I never had that because maybe that wasn't who I was, but then I also later on had these parents. Mm-hmm. I have people like my big brother where he had no choice. Mom was a drug addict. He had two siblings supporting. You're 14. She cracked out. What are you going to do? Call 911 and get, you know, the foster care. You know, I've had pivotal moments in my life, you know, where my friends, I had one of my best friends to this day. We didn't really, I wouldn't say we didn't like each other. I was from one side of Berkeley. He was from the other side of Berkeley. You know, we'll talk a lot of shit and that was it. And what pivotal moment for him that changed our relationship is when he realized that he was selling drugs to my mom in high school, my biological mother. And that really changed our relationship. And he went to jail twice on some another charge, on some federal drug charges. And in that moment, I didn't put money on his books. But we've been close since then. I'm actually going to be the godfather to his son. But this tells you how things work. I know we're kind of all over the place.
No. But this is good. You mentioned earlier you had one of your best friends, if not your best friend, was killed. How was he killed?
Shot. Hmm.
I'm sorry. And how old was he?
23. You know, I've had some friends I grew up with. And I think a lot of the deaths back at home start happening once I'm left for college. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a good friend who was killed. Grew up with a child friend that killed in front of his house. My other best friend was just killed. Kind of like a guy I grew up with, like a cousin of mine, shot and killed in a parking lot. My best friend actually came out to my high school graduation. He's been missing since 2005. Wrote an article, not for sure what happened. He's been missing since 2005. You know, you become desensitized. And we talk about mental health. We talk about issues impacting people when they see death, when people have been killed, or when they see physical abuse, and how does one talk about it and not become so desensitized to it? Because when you become that, you don't know how to deal with it. You don't know how to process it. You got to process death. A lot of close people I have been killed. And so it's about me. You know, I think when people look at me this one way of Josh Gray, and it's like, oh my God, this guy is so cultured and he has his white family and he's like, love all these things. And then they get to know this other side, which is so like, oh my God, this is so shocking. You know, especially when you look within the black community, because we're non-monolithic. That's the first thing. And especially over the past 40 years, Eugene Robinson, the journalist for the Washington Post, wrote a book that's called Disintegration. It really talks about that. And I often think about that because I am that. You know, for so long within our Black community, our Blackness, we've allowed society to define what our Blackness is. And our Blackness, allegedly, is supposed to be, you got to grow up in the hood, you got to grow up poor, you got to be Black, to be a real Black person, you have to have these stripes. And for me, I'm like, fuck no. Like, you know, for me, when I went to Howard. And so that was a transition from like growing up poor Black to then for 8 months, I moved with my white parents because I didn't have a place to live. I called them when I realized that my aunt told me I couldn't move back into her house because I wasn't getting money from the system. My grandmother told me that, well, you got to work full time, so forget college. And I called my parents and they were like, well, you don't have a place to live. My dad took the wash and dryer out of the back room, moved into the hallway, put a futon on the floor, and I slept there for 8 months. Got into Howard when 2 years ago, I wasn't sure I was going to college. Their friends and family paid my first year. And I paid for my last 4 years through loans.
Wow.
And with $7,000 short, took a personal loan from like one of the loan companies my senior year.
So when you arrive at Howard, and I mean, here you have really, I mean, the experience you had from ninth grade to 12th grade, particularly the way that it ended and having to move in with Jackie and Larry. I don't think there's many kids, college freshmen, who have had that kind of life experience at that point. What was college? What was it like for you?
Jacob Lawrence is one of my favorite artists of all time. If anyone who visit DC, you have to go to the Phillips Collection. And I'm not trying to get all art snobby on you, but Jacob Lawrence is my favorite. He actually drew the migration series of Blacks coming from the South up north when he was 23 years old. It's amazing. I actually had a good podcast on him last week. So Jacob Lawrence is my favorite. And so often I'm saying that to say the migration of Black Americans from the South to the West is often not really, I wouldn't say it's not noted. Obviously, it's not as big as from the South to the North. Don't get me wrong, right? Because, I mean, D.C. was the first Harlem Renaissance before Harlem Renaissance. Like, let's, and all I had to say was, because of that migration, you saw the mannerisms. When I moved to D.C., I was like, fuck, I'm back in Oakland. You know, it was like, you felt like, even though it wasn't, it was so much the same. It was just so much the same. Like, yeah, the dialect was different, but it was just more like, oh, well, my family from Oakland, my other family from Oakland, or you saw it maybe more from like Mississippi or Louisiana, they moved to Oakland, but you just felt like, oh, well, you guys listen to E-40. I listen to E-40. You guys listen to the Loonies, Capri Classic Cars. We drive Capri Classics. You know, I was like, this is home. My relatability was this, is that they looked like me and I came from that same background of the struggle.
So you felt like you were home.
I felt like I was home.
It felt great.
Now, here's the difference. I don't want you to think I didn't answer your question. I said D.C. was home. I didn't say Howard. D.C. So there was a difference. My relatability was poor Black. Now, how am I transitioning to, your parents went to college. See, I never had, oh, you're a Black parent.
Your grandmother did not go to college.
So you had, what is legacy? Oh, you have legacy. Oh, what is legacy? Oh, your great, great, great. Oh, that's legacy. Oh, what is HBC? Now, mind you, I'm a kid who was a president of the Black Student Union at Berkeley High School.
Yep.
We're the first school to ever have an African-American studies department. But mind you, I was only looking at state schools and went into universities in California. Wait, what is this? So you're talking about mind-blowing for me?
So it's a whole different level.
40% of the kids who went to Howard grew up in white suburban years, and it came to Howard for a Black experience. Here's the thing, Jim. I didn't need a Black experience. Whatever that meant, right? A Black experience meaning like having Black friends. I didn't need that. And guess what I didn't need, Jim? A white experience, because I already had a whole ass white family.
So what did you need?
Right. You know, like I already had this white, and like, you know, my friend's like, why? I'm like, my mother dropped me off. My mother's a 5'9" tall white woman. You know, I'm not biracial for those of you like who can't see me. I'm 6'1", dark skin, bald head, glasses. Okay. So When you're thinking your mom wearing a Howard sweatshirt.
With a Howard hat on.
With a Howard hat on, right? And so when people see my mom, you know, your son is must be this biracial kid. I'm like, no, your son is a 6'1", dressed, deep voice black kid, right? It's funny. And so I'm saying it to say is that.
So you felt a little bit like a fish out of water. You felt a little bit like I don't completely fit in here.
For 1 second.
Okay.
But because when you're black and then younger and you're now been with all these older white people, you had to be comfortable. So that was, I was always able to, I call myself like a chameleon. Like I had to just go ahead and blend in and do those things.
You could walk into any room and.
I know it's fine. I still don't know what it is to have an upper middle class black experience or that, whatever else one can say that. Because my experiences were so either poor or upper middle class white. Like, you know, so the Cosby experience that one might have seen during in the 80s and 90s, I didn't, you know, that was, wasn't me. Now, I should say this. The challenge that I had at Howard, and I love Howard, great experience. I made some great friends. I have a brother, basically, he's like a brother to me, named Junius. I have really great friends, great experience, memorable moments. You know, there was a woman who passed away, there was a provost there. She's like my Howard mom. So I had some Howard moms, great experience. The one thing that I have to do, and, you know, I'm pretty secretive when it comes to my life. I also saw young black men trying to sell drugs, trying to portray this toughness about them. Like, oh, yeah, from Newark, when you're from Teaneck. It's okay that you're from Teaneck, New Jersey, and your family's college educated. Because you know what? I grew up poor as fuck. And I have a sister, we and my sister supported me and looked out for me. We looked out for each other as much as we could. Like, I grew up poor. So this is what you think you're growing, like, trying to be. I live that. Like, I've seen people get killed. I've seen it, and it's not cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge for me was, like, why are we portraying something when we're at a school that all my friends who grew up the way I grew up would love to be my opportunity? And I'm going to say this, is that The Hilltop is an amazing paper that's our school paper.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing journalist there. As you know, one of those that came out was Ta-Nehisi Coates out of Howard, and which is, again, I think the modern day Baldwin. And I wrote an article called ID Card. And the article talked about me growing up, me having to wear my sister underwear when I didn't have any underwear when they weren't clean, me having to make syrup sandwiches and be out of canned foods. And I share some of my most vulnerable moments to share that to be who you are. Stop portraying something that you're not. That you're not less black because you didn't grow up a certain way. Do not allow someone to question your blackness because you grew up in an educated family. That you might even grown up with a silver spoon in your mouth. Because those who come from that type of background who's here or who didn't make it wish they had those opportunities. And I had to speak to that. And that was important for me. And that was one of my moments at Howard where I often struggled with kids who wanted to pretend something that they were not when I was just so fortunate to be at Howard when the odds were against me completely, statistically, and when people didn't think I could make it.
Yeah, and it must have been hard to listen to that when, you know, you grew up in that neighborhood and you saw those kids who were, you know, dealing drugs or were tough and, you know, and to see kids pretending or acting like they're come from that. And you're thinking, no, I know what it's like firsthand. But wait, I got to stop. A syrup sandwich. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Boy, that sounds good. What is that? Just syrup on bread?
That's it. Oh. Man, that's when you're hungry, man. That's really it. In the 80s, my father would kill me because he hates when I say back in the day, because even though I'm 39, he still thinks I'm too young to say back in the day. They don't do this anymore, but you grew up, yeah, government, you know, the government is to send you a box and you just put it right in front of your house. And the box would just contain powdered milk, block cheese, and canned goods in the 80s. I remember that.
Really?
That's what we used to get. Yeah.
So you graduate from Howard.
So I go to Howard.
And do you head back to California or do you stay here?
No, I stay here, California. Howard was great. I met another kind of like a mom, kind of like a godmother who's great. Struggled academic probation twice, you know, because you can't feel like you caught up from years of academically being behind, all of a sudden being, you know, caught up and now you're great in college. And then my last 3 years, got it together, made Dean's List. My mom, again, I mentioned, was a sports journalist, thought I wanted to be in front of the camera. Wind up changing, realized that I was already going to do 5 years. I couldn't change my major. So I kept my major as broadcast journalist, journalism. And kept my minor as political science. And then decided to change my focus. I think I mentioned that I had an intern to George Michael machine. And
let's go to the videotape.
Go videotape. And the first day I called my mom and said, I can't do it. She goes, what do you mean? I said, Mom, I think this is not for me. I think I'm going to focus on politics. So she found me an internship at a civil rights nonprofit. And then that was it. I focused on politics.
Off and running. So tell us about your current job, your current work.
Yeah, that's funny because my internship back when I was 20 was actually with the current role I'm in now, or the job. So my mom found this job or internship for the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. And this is the longest civic engagement civil rights organization. This is our 45th anniversary. Really great organization that focuses on, one, educating individuals, registering them to vote, getting them out to vote. We also have particular programs. We focus on our Rebuild, Rehope, Equity, and Justice, our 45-year anniversary. With that, we do a mix of issues around, we were part of the Black Census Roundtable that happened with National Urban League around making your voice and counted and making sure you're counted. That was a big focus, and now redistricting. We do a variety of things underneath our big umbrella. Our leading anchors are Black Women's Roundtable, where we've worked with Essence and do our polling on the issues that are affecting Black people, particularly Black women. That has been really an issue, whether it's coming through health, family paid leave, focusing on Black entrepreneurship. As you know, as we're focusing on the rebuild part, often Black community and people of color are often left out when it comes to rebuilding. With any great recession, if you look at the Great Recession, we're often left out, mostly impacted, but then left out. And so we want to make sure there's equity when it comes to who's been now a part of that rebuilding. And so that's kind of what we've been fighting for, as well as entrepreneur challenges, et cetera. So we're doing a lot of great things, and I'm just so happy as almost 2 months into this role as the Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Policy. So as, you know, we continue to do the work of identifying our partners, we're nonpartisan, identifying partners to push some of our policy issues, but then supporting others and their policy issues. Obviously, whether it's pushing, you know, what we're fighting for when it comes to, I mentioned paid leave, when it comes to right now the vaccine, we understand the distribution of the vaccine has not been reflective of those who've mostly been impacted, which are African-American. So we're focusing on that as well. Equal distribution of it is really important. So that's my role. And then bringing in kind of corporate partners to see the value of this and map that out through that and Rebuild Hope, which is coming from a racial equity lens.
Well, Josh, I think you will be great. I'm sure you're great. Just started, but I'm sure you'll be great at that. There's no doubt in my mind. So first of all, I think this is going to be the longest podcast that we.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, Josh. I think that speaks volumes about what a great episode this is.
I hope it was good enough. I think it was all over.
But so I have a couple. I think I'm going to have Jackie and Larry on.
Yeah,
we're going to have to deviate. And so a couple of questions. One, to people that want to help out, it seems like, you know, Jackie really made an incredible difference in your life. And so for people that want to help, want to make a difference, looking into after-school programs or whatever it may be in their local town or area, maybe something that everyone should take a look at.
And mentorship is important.
Okay.
That's, you know, for sure, you know, because there could be another Josh Ray out there. And that's really the role they played, Jackie and Larry played, or continue to play in my life. You know, my parents never had a kid. I'm their only child. And they are the reason who I am today. You know, I'm talking to you, Jim, this comfortability to you, Jim, this ability, you know, and I mentioned to you about vulnerability. I went to therapy in 2019 and constantly read books like the Care Package, A Path to Deep Healing, to address some of my issues. is because my mom, like, hey, listen, I'm going to help you pay. Like, you want to go to therapy? I'm going to help you pay for that. Or I'll pay for one session, you pay for the next session. You pay every other session. Like, having that support, understanding, you know, knocking that stigma away is important.
Well, and you talk about that stigma. Josh and I only spoke once briefly before this interview. Tell the story about walking in Georgetown.
Yeah. So I was having, it's a funny story. I was actually ordering, I think I probably just ordered my best friend, his name is Francis, Frank Sinatra. And he taught me how to order a martini. Oh, Jacqueline said it. So I was having my martini with three olives stuffed with blue cheese. And I have my little hat on. And I'm sitting at this restaurant. And I wouldn't use the restroom. I remember it because I was wearing a black double-breasted corduroy suit with Converse, a black cashmere turtleneck, and a wide-brimmed hat. I got up. This older white woman with him, he goes, "You look like a rapper." She's like, "Are you a rapper?" And I responded, "No, I'm an opera singer, actually. And actually, I perform," and I mentioned this to you, but I forgot to mention this. It's like, "But I perform for La Traviata, but I also have done some stuff for Philip Glass." And the look on her face, she was like, could not believe it. She was like, "Wait, what?" And I was like, "Yeah." And she's like, couldn't believe that response. You know?
Yeah. It highlights what you're talking about earlier to have her say that. And I love your response. I just love that. Josh could have said, "No, I'm not a rapper. Excuse me." And you're like, "I think I'm going to have a little fun."
No,
here.
But be real about it, right? You know, yeah, my father's talking about a cook and he would listen to classical music.
Yeah.
I fell in love with that.
Yeah. And you love the opera.
I reference art. My mother's a big modernist. My father's impressionist. So having that exposure, but I listen to rap all the time, which you don't need to know,
Yeah. And then Josh, so you've thought about starting a podcast. If you started a podcast, what would it be on?
Great question. So I have the name for it. I actually have it. I just haven't recorded it. It's called A Friend of Mine, Strimbalia. It's like, you need to do a podcast. You have a good voice. I think you say some really good things. You probably should do it. And it's called Great Compositions. It's a podcast intertwined between a Sunday afternoon, cigars, and jazz. And so this has really covered a variety of different topics, from politics to sports to culture, wherever culture means. So to finding my voice, you know, I mentioned this to you, I dated this woman when I was back at home, and she was a voice coach, or she is. She's actually a really good executive coach, and she works for Fortune 50 companies, and she's a mirror career coach, executive coach, and voice coach. And she goes, "You have a great voice, but why are you hiding it?" And I realized that a lot of my voice back prior to meeting her was like a high-pitched voice, because I was mimicking how I learned how to speak properly with my white family, but not really truly accepting the voice I had. So it was so funny. I was like, it took a white woman to have me, who I love to this day, we're really good friends, her name is Hillary, to have me fully accept my voice. And that's one of the topics I wanted to have, was owning your voice. And not just your actual voice, but owning your voice in spaces.
Yeah.
And so what I realized that I own my voice, I am who I am in all spaces.
I think it's great. Literally your own voice and your own voice. Yeah, you do have a great, great voice for radio or podcast. Well, I think you should do it, Josh. I think you have a lot to say. You have a lot of insight. This has been just a phenomenal conversation. And it's just really just been wonderful. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. And thanks, Stephanie, for introducing us. And for our listeners out there, remember, you can follow us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And you can sign up for our Monday email that comes out, obviously, every Monday. And you can do that at our website, thepoliticallife.com. And we hope you all stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great week. And we will see you next Monday.